What is it like to reread them again or look at them again?
Neither, to me. Boredom of the most acute kind. It seems totally trivial to me now. Not trivial, but completely local. It belongs to their own time, maybe. They describe events which appeared important at the time, or at least interesting at the time, which I don't think anyone would know, many of which they would now remember. There's only one reviewer who did them justice. That was a man called, a man who wrote The Life of Montgomery, and Steve Volumes, who said, as he yawned from page to page, he was simply unable to go on. So I was told that this man of has some reputation, produces a work of infinite tedium, containing nothing of interest at all. I sympathize with him. A man called Hamilton.
All right.
The London Review
of Books. Let's cut through a little of this false modesty. If they were such an enormous bore to read 40 years... They were all right in their time.
Yes.
How can you account for their success?
They were written with certain librarians, and I was much interested in what I was writing. I did it with great pleasure and a certain amount of malice and interest and partisanship.
Yes.
I was a Roosevelt partisan, a rather concealed kind,
yes.
Although we were told to be neutral in word and thought and deed.
Yes.
I was not neutral.
Yes.
And I don't think many people in my embassy were as unneutral as I.
Yes. You said nice things about Wilkie.
He was a perfectly nice man. I had lunch with him. I don't know whether I described it.
I can't remember.
I did have lunch with him in New York, yes. John Foster was someone who knew him. It wasn't terribly interesting. We talked about Helen Lemain, which I think he knew something about. Either he was there or he...
Yes, he was there.
I think he was there. He was actually there. Mm-hmm. He described it. He was a thoroughly nice man. Simple, hearty, dull, decent kind. Like a good German.
Yeah.
Which is roughly what he was.
Yeah. Well, how would you account once more for their... the extraordinary interest that they do seem to have awakened in the 100 or so people who read them attentively in Whitehall in the war?
Simply because they were in contrast with what went on before. You see, I didn't invent the genre.
Yeah.
It was done from the embassy by the third secretary, who knew nothing very much about his own job to do. And all that happened was that there was some kind of press cutting agencies within the embassy, a very minor kind. And they stuck little bits of newspaper onto large sheets, and a black man carried them around from room to room, and when people read them, the black man took them away again. That's all to them.
Yes.
Told me, well, this man had much more to go on, but I knew one of the people who did it. My immediate predecessor was a man called Etherington Smith, later ambassador to Mongolia. And he said that all he was told to do by Neville Butler, who was the minister under Lothian, was simply to read the summary of the news in the New York Times and condense it. That really wasn't... they could have read the condensed summary anyway.
In so London, though you didn't invent the genre, you vastly extended the range of its sources and references.
I enlivened it. I made it a bit more pertinent. You see, first of all, I got all the clippings in New York. Second, I knew people. I knew people in the White House, I knew people in the State Department, and I knew journalists. I was made a member of the press club, and for some reason, it was very nice for me. I didn't get there very often. But they tended to palm off stories onto me, which they couldn't print, and if I didn't, I couldn't use them. Too speculative. I was amused to listen to them.
Yeah.
And I had friends among the journalists, not very many. My greatest friend in Washington was the correspondent of the Times. It was a man called...
Brandon? No.
Oh, no, long
before Brandon.
No, 1941, 42. He was called Wilmot Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Lewis. He was a great friend of Good Mary Senators. He'd been there for a long time. He was a cynical, clever old man. He used to invite senators to dinner and cooked their meals in the kitchen. They told him everything. He was very much that type. Shrewd old journalist who had worked in Seoul, in Korea, before he came to war. He was far the most famous British journalist in Washington, well known as the unofficial ambassador from the United Kingdom, which was called.
Yeah.
And he was a, as I say, a jolly old man who was pompous, but extremely entertaining. You went to Oxford, my dear boy. As for me, I had to enjoy the inferior benefits of Heidelberg and the Sorbonne. That was tough. That was tough. It seemed that he knew an awful lot, because people talked to him very freely, because he was so sympathetic to them and understood. And well, when the, for example, when the Harkies and Oakies, you know, when whatever it was, a famous book by the man who rightly thought he ought not to win the Nobel Prize. Think of an American novelist who wrote about the people who were ruined by the erosion of their soil.
You don't mean Faulkner?
No. I'm not as good as Faulkner. Very nice man, but when he got the Nobel Prize, he said he didn't see, didn't really think his way by the old. Nor was he. Edmund Wilson was described as the exact line between literature and journalism.
Steinbeck.
Steinbeck. Well, now, Steinbeck wrote about the Oklahoma people, Hokies, they were called, I think, who had to leave the state because they were ruined and so on. Well, Wilmot Lewis gave quite a lot of money to these people of his own.
Yeah.
So he was part of the American scene in some genuine way, which none of his successes were.
Yes.
So that's how it got me going. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I saw exactly how
it was done.
It was done.
Why did you take like a duck to water to journalism? Here you are, this extremely studious and highly intellectual don of Central European culture, and you absolutely, the reports are extraordinarily convincing imitations of the cleverest American pressman. I find this a kind of almost like as if you were engaged in a kind of ventriloquism of an extraordinary
kind.
There was
a graphologist, Austrian graphologist, who once looked at my handwriting and said, your métier is that of a journalist. And it is. I'm by nature probably meant to be a journalist. I think I would have made quite a good one. I applied for a job in Manchester Guardian very early in life, 1931, in my third year in Oxford. Was rejected without examination. Well, I was asked by C.P. Scott, the most famous editor, have you great facility in writing? None, I said. I didn't blame him.
But you mean you should have been a journalist? This is
no,
part of your rich vernacular of ironic self-criticism.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, I have a natural tendency to gossip, to describing things, to noticing things, to interest in human beings and their characters, to interplay in human beings, which is completely independent of my intellectual pursuits. But even when writing about history of ideas, which ultimately was more congenial to me than philosophy, I either do or pretend to myself that I do possess some degree of insight into both the motives of individual thinkers or of the general tendency and character of the milieu in which and for which they write.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a gift to journalists or to possess. And that, I think, I have by nature.
Did it teach you anything? This is a sort of foolish question in its generality, but did the experience of, as they say, being where history was being made or where history was being witnessed, and then producing these reports, which in the distance of time often seem too close to the events, teach you anything about history, about how it's,
well,
as a historian?
Not directly, no. People always think it does. Yes, it gave me, didn't teach me anything. It probably gave me some sort of views of it, rightly or wrongly. Teaches me that it's the truth. I'm not so sure that the impression I got was necessarily valid.
One of the things it seems to have taught you is that, which you already knew, is that men matter.
Yeah, mainly that. And circumstances matter. And crises matter. that he can go either way. Great distrust of creating personal forces.
Great distrust of. What do you mean about crises? What are you trying to say?
That critical moments of history when things are on the brink. Either there's going to be a war or there's not going to be a war. Either there's going to be a crucial vote in some democratic assembly or decision of a very, very crucial kind by dictator. What this matters, what this depends on, are not circumstances accounted for by the broad horizons of someone like, what's the name of the greatest French historian of our time? Brodel.
Brodel.
Yes.
Ça ne joue pas.
No good. What I mean is that if Hitler had not attacked Russia, things would have gone differently. Mm-hmm. If a brick had fallen on Lenin before 1917, it's no use saying climate and economic factors and human habits and health and mortality.
Yes. Kerensky might have won through.
I don't think he would, but somebody else would. Yes. I mean, about Russian history, it's clear to me that the Russian Revolution, the first revolution happened almost in person.
Yes.
And it's no good anyone maintained.
But the second was contingent.
The second was not, maybe it wasn't contingent as a revolution, but it was contingent as the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes.
If Lenin had not lived, there is nobody in the Communist Politburo who could have dominated the country.
Yes.
Just nobody.
Yes.
I mean, Trotsky was the only person of sufficient gifts. He was a Jew, out of question in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't have happened.
Yes.
Zinoviev, nothing. Kamenev, nothing. Stalin, non-existent.
Yes. Yes.
Therefore, what would have happened would have been a civil war between Kerensky plus the Bolsheviks plus the left and Kornilov and the right of the White Army. It's all right. The White Army might have won. If the White Army had won, we would have had something like Alexander of Yugoslavia. I mean, we might have had a military dictatorship or maybe new Tsar. Some radical differences maybe because the peasants wouldn't have given up the land quite so easily. I don't say, but the communist regime, Marxism, would not have won.
Yes. And similarly, in the Second War, had the Japanese not attacked Pearl Harbor,
the Americans might not have entered the war.
Yes.
I always thought, I think I told you, that Roosevelt believed that he could win the war without fighting it.
Yes.
Certainly.
Yes.
And I never remember what happened. Did the Americans become all the Japanese, didn't they? Not vice versa.
That's right.
They did become, well, obviously, after Pearl Harbor. What happened about the Germans?
And they then followed.
Who declared war on whom?
That I don't know.
I have a feeling that the Americans declared war on Germany.
Once
because they were allies of Japanese.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right.
But the question
the
is
declaration of war doesn't follow immediately. It follows almost
a day or two later. Very, very soon. It happened, yes. But supposing Americans had not declared war on the Germans, just fought the Pacific War, which would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible. Unlikely, but not impossible.
Yes.
There were a lot of people in America who would have liked it.
Yes.
The whole of what used to call the Iso-Pacific movement.
Yes. One of the things in those dispatches that did strike me as genuinely perceptive was not, you know, predictions of future affairs, but you did seem to me to be very perceptive indeed about the volatility of American opinion. The basic self-congratulatory character of American opinion, the self-centeredness of American opinion.
Well, American way of life, I mean, in fact, somebody once says religion of America is America.
Yeah.
There's certain truth about that.
Yeah.
I did invent one bogus dispatch, but it did not reprint.
Oh, really?
Yes. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if I found it afterwards. Maybe it was just exposed. About a man called Elmer Peabody, some such name in the Middle West, wasn't Peabody, who was a candidate for the presidency. Didn't get very many votes. It was an old program. I followed his fortunes for about 3 dispatches and then had to kill him off. Just to see if anyone would find out it wasn't true.
And nobody did?
No.
Really?
No. Oh.
But these men through the ambassador, that's playing a rather dangerous joke.
Well, he signed these things.
He signed them.
Really read them. Right. People in Trotsky read them.
Yeah.
But I don't know what I knew. I don't know. I discovered some Middle Western maverick. He would have been in newspapers, but I don't think they read newspapers much. The British Embassy was not the diplomatic part of it. The, as it were, Foreign Office part of it was not in touch with American events and opinion. The food mission was, the raw materials mission was, the financial mission, all these amateur missions consisting of non-Foreign Office types.
Yeah.
But the diplomatic mission was not exactly responsive. I mean, I was more as an instrument for this purpose.
Mm.
I noticed, I mean, there were streams of contained. They had their American friends, but people were all themselves.
Yeah.
President Bush is a great friend of the present British ambassador.
Yes.
And that is exactly as it should be. They could both be members of Brooks'
club.
Club,
yes. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether British government policy towards Palestine was one of the issues that strained your loyalty as a servant of Her Majesty's government.
Yes, yes. It didn't strain my loyalty. That is not difficult. We're at war. And so nothing arose. I remained a Zionist. How widely this was known, I can't tell you. All I can tell you is that when I was appointed, I discovered a dispatch by Neville Butler, who was saying that I was suitable for the post on the ground that I was a respectable, fellow of all souls, non-Zionist Jew. Why I said that? I can't tell you that. I don't know. I wasn't asked. But I never knew what to say. It was well after the war.
That's about as accurate as their vetting of Anthony Blunt.
That's for example, the dispatch of him. I saw it among in the sort of public record office.
Yeah.
And no. The fact that I was Zionist was known to people. It was known to my friend Anthony Rumbold, who was my friend at the embassy. It was known to Michael Wright, who was a violent anti-Zionist, of the most ferocious kind, who knew me to be there, and that's why dispatched it specifically to do with Zionism and that sort of thing, probably weren't forwarded to me. Quite possible.
Right.
But and I used to see Zionists and I used to report what they said. So it wasn't, I mean, for Jew Zionists, all was very unconcealed. I didn't see very many. Very few Jews, not all many Zionists, but still, my opinions weren't regarded as extreme, nor were they. No, it didn't strain my loyalty, but when I was offered a job in the Foreign Office, after the war, I didn't accept it. One of the two reasons. The first reason was, I was very amused by my work, and I wasn't all that ready to go back to academic life. I did it with pleasure, but I could have been seduced for two reasons. One was, I didn't want to be too discreet. I didn't want to live two lives, which what I discovered, because the documents could not be spoken about, and I would then have to be. I was deeply impressed by something that David Sisson once said to me. He said that two professions would dehydrate people, kill them. One is the law, and the other is diplomacy. Because one has to defend positions in which one doesn't believe. The duty of a Foreign Office official is to prevent things from boiling over, prevent war, if you like, and defend the interests of the country and its citizens abroad.
Yes.
Which is very proper, they should do.
Yes.
These things are necessary.
Yes.
Just the spying is necessary, maybe. But it does mean that in the course of time, the sense of right and wrong becomes extremely petrified.
Yes. So there was that general objection, and then there was a specific objection about
the
Zionists.
Zionist. I thought, well, the Foreign Office was anti-Zionist, not quite to a man, the State Department was.
Mm.
I mean, all my friends, State Department, I made intimate friends there. They were all anti-Zionist. And they knew me to be a Zionist. I used to argue with them, but it wasn't part of their agreement. It was a very peaceful argument.
Yeah.
They were partly convinced by what I said, but not very much, or as I talked to them. They weren't anti-Semitic, but anti-Zionist, they said, you know. Most of them were anti-Semitic too, but not perhaps the ones I made friends with. But because I thought that this would ultimately form a problem, it would mean that I'd always have to be sent to Ecuador. I was kept away from the Eastern Department.
Yes.
You see what I mean? But the fact that special treatment,
yes,
just like German Americans during the First World War who couldn't be conscripted properly.
Yes.
That sort of thing. I mean, what's called special interest.
Yes. But 45, 46, 47, the Foreign Office's policy and Benin's policy towards Palestine really does become very, very hard to take for anybody of Zionist conviction.
Bevin is one of the founders of Israel. Weizmann and Bevin between them are the twin pillars on which the Israel state rests. Without Bevin, there would have been no Palestine, no Jewish state. It's rather violent thing to say. Maybe there would have been. I mean, I can't say. In the end, maybe yes. But the point was that when Truman agreed to, offered Bevin the prospect of Hetley was equally into Zionist in a quiet sort of stony way. From the beginning, he hated the Balfour Declaration in 17.
Yeah.
From the very beginning. Bevin appeared on Zionist platforms before the war.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that it must have been a sort of gradual process.
Yes.
But anyway, supposing they'd accepted Truman's offer of 100,000 Jews, immigration of 100,000 Jews into Palestine in 46, 47. Supposing they'd accepted that, that would have been America's contribution. They wouldn't have gone further. They would not have accepted the Jewish state.
Yes.
See, it's because America recognized it that it came to be, or could come to be. But the fact that the British refused this, because the Arabs and so on, would have risen because of the war. You see, all kinds of things that might have, done that. No, Bevin really was an architect of the Jewish state.
An unintended architect.
Well, now they say...
An ironic architect.
Well, now they say on the documents, I can't remember who, there's a man called Schleim, that's an entity, who's an Iraqi Jew, who is a revisionist.
Avi Schleim.
I don't know him, yes, but he's a reader in international relations. He's an Iraqi Jew, and he's a sort of revisionist historian of those days.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's probably quite reliable, I don't know. According to him, Bevin was prepared for a Jewish state, much smaller than what had happened, but had reconciled himself to the idea of having Jew. But it never emerged. He never said that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody among the Jews would have known it.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was of extreme violence.
Mm-hmm.
The climax was when he insisted on, remember there was the Exodus, and they were forced back into the camps.
Yes.
Back into the camps.
Mm-hmm.
That was somehow something which the whole world was horrified
yes.
by.
Yes.
But that was maybe.
Yes.
So it showed a very violent anti-Semitic feeling.
Yes.
It wasn't just a piece of political anti-Zionism.
Yes, and it's one aspect, incidentally, which is irrelevant to this, why nostalgia for the Labour Party of 1945 has always been one thing I've been rather impervious to, precisely because of that. It seemed to me that in another
Bevin
area...
Bevin was rather exceptional. You see, the Zionists were more shocked by Bevin's policy, you can imagine. You see, their relations with the Labour Party were extremely, as they thought, intimate.
Yes.
Once the Labour Party came into power, there was no doubt they would get what they wanted, quite a lot of it. The fact they didn't was an absolute... They could be knocked out with a feather.
Yes.
It was more astonishing.
Yes.
To the Labour, you see, look, Dalton was a friend.
Mm-hmm.
He was shrine Semitic privately, but so he was a friend. He wanted exchange of populations, literally in favor of moving Arabs out.
Yes.
Let me see, who else were the Labour ministers? Morrison was not an enemy.
Mm.
Hadley didn't know it. Hadley was, but that's concealed.
Mm.
Who were the Labour ministers? Creech Jones, Mr. Gill was very pro. Wait a minute.
Labour politicians.
That's not part of. Extraordinary. But then Creech Jones is a friend. Who were the Labour ministers of that period?
Cripps.
Cripps was anti. On sort of Webb like lines. Pro native. Anti white.
Yes.
Roughly,
Yeah.
Was he anti nationalist?
Yeah.
Cripps was anti. Bevin? Yes. Well, Bevin was really taken into... I'll tell you, Bevin was complex. Partly the Foreign Office had been anti from start to finish. Partly anti-Semitism, partly friendship with the Arabs. It was thought to be necessary. There's quite a decent article about this, about a fortnight ago, by, of all people, Lord Beloff, in the Times, which I recommend to you. Quiet, decent, not a man I greatly admire, or with politics I greatly admire. Decent, quite respectable, and criticizing, not by name, Walter Graves' recent journey, you see. Quite a good article, and a speech by him, House of Lords, also. Quite decent. I mean, not wonderful, but certainly the most moderate and convincing thing written by anybody.
Yes.
Couldn't be accused of bubbling out pro-Zionist prejudice.
Yes.
So I recommend it.
Yes.
Oddly enough, if we turn it up. Now, wait a moment. Partly that, and partly Bevin's imagination, one could see. You see, Bevin was around like Khrushchev, really, as a type. Didn't like intellectuals. Didn't like clever Jews. Was kept out of the Fabian Society by Lasky, I should think. Was, to some extent, intellectually ambitious, wanted to be part of the movement. He thought of Palestine as filled with Arab peasants, decent people, more or less like himself, like peasants anyway, potential trade unions, which is all he cared for. Having the sort of bedeviled, driven mad by a lot of Lasky's, financed by cigar-chomping rich American Jews sitting in New York.
Capitalists.
Capitalists who had no intention of going there themselves.
Yes.
That's the image.
Yes.
I'm sure. There's some truth in it, too. It wasn't totally false.
Right.
You see?
Yes.
But I'm sure that's what he thought.
Yes. To get back to Washington in the war.
But it's true, I would have felt uncomfortable at moments in the Foreign Office. I thought there's no point in taking this on. Because the policy was so 100% anti, as I could see it from the telegrams.
Did you, shifting gears slightly, did you feel more comfortable or less comfortable as a Jew in the United States?
Neither one nor the other. I wasn't a Jew in the United States. I was a Jew in the British Embassy. In British circles, I was part of the British establishment, quite genuinely. I mean, I wasn't a Jew in the British establishment exactly. Maybe subjectively I was there, but rather objectively. Subjectively, I sort of circulated as a kind of Englishman, and not as a sort of cozy another Jew in America. Who got on with American Jews. Of course I got on with them more naturally than an Englishman would. Nevertheless, they saw me as a British official, all the same. And I really was.
Yes.
I so behaved.
Yes,
I see. No. You see, was I more comfortable? No. No. Didn't think so, no. What I did feel, I was more comfortable politically in America than I was in England.
Yes.
That is true. Because the New Deal was exactly what I believed.
Yes.
I mean, the Labour Party, I wasn't sure. The New Deal was exactly the right mix for me, for capitalism and socialism.
Yeah.
It still is, you see. And as I told you before, Washington is more like Oxford than it was like England. Did I tell you that?
Yes.
I mean, the relationships were so personal. That I could understand. Hence my journalism again.
Yes, I see. Now, you went back to England. I can't remember what the footnotes in the dispatches say, but 42,
twice.
43, something like that?
42 and 44.
Yes. I'm just 45. Wondering the contrast between even the wartime austerity of Washington, the wartime austerity of Britain must have been fairly staggering.
There's no wartime austerity in Washington at all.
At all.
It just wasn't it.
What was it like to go back and forth between these two capitals?
Well, I went back first in 40.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You see? And of course, I told you, I had landed in Bristol in this seaplane from Portugal, and there was immediately Blitz in Bristol.
Yeah.
That day, I felt very well. I thought that's what I'd come back for. I felt better than not being in America at that moment.
When is that, November 40?
This is October 14th.
October 14th.
Early October.
Did you fly, incidentally, did you fly direct by seaplane from Lisbon?
Certainly, there's any way. I think we went to Bristol. Yeah. I think that could have been the only reason.
Yeah.
We didn't go to some inland port.
Yeah.
First seaplane is by clipper, you see, from New York to Lisbon.
Yes.
I think seaplanes were meant in 40.
Uh-huh.
I don't think ordinary airplanes, apart from wartime, I mean, uh-huh. military ones,
uh-huh.
they operated. Civilian ones, I'm not sure.
Right. Right.
At least not.
And this seaplane was a military plane. This was an RAF plane.
No.
No, it was...
No. Ordinary seaplane.
Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to...
No, no.
So you came back in 40 and you felt better because you were part of
well,
the
because I was,
crisis.
Well, because my position in America was very ambivalent. I didn't, as I told you, I didn't mean to be there.
Yeah.
I told you about that
yeah.
whole story.
Yeah.
Because what was I doing in America?
Yeah.
As I told you, I had something in Oxford, something in Moscow, but I just happened to be stuck watching
yeah.
New York
yeah.
because I didn't get to Moscow. And I felt that... I was concealing myself, there was
yes.
ambusque.
Yeah.
That's all that I wanted to be.
Yes.
Yeah. Very, well, particularly Jews shouldn't behave like that.
Yes.
You see.
And then 42 you came back.
I came back at 40 the first time, and straight to Oxford, from Bristol. And then 42 years. In 42 I came back in a seaplane again.
You flew to Lisbon again and then?
No. Wait. I came to Lim, the south coast.
Lim in the south coast of Portugal?
No, of England.
Oh, Lim.
L-Y-M-P-N-E.
Ah.
I think there's the airport there.
Right.
In the sea, I'm on the channel.
Hmm.
How did we fly?
A direct flight from New York?
I think directly, yes.
Through Gander or one of those, I think.
That sort of thing. We may have stopped in, that's right, we may have stopped in Newfoundland or something.
Oh.
I don't know, that might have happened. But, I remember. In 1940, we stopped in Horta, in the Azores.
Right.
In 1942, we stopped for a moment, I think, somewhere in between, like Newfoundland, or Canada, as you say.
Yeah. What were those journeys like by plane? Bloody awful, I would have thought.
They took about 8 hours, yes. It took 8 or 9 hours. 9 hours. They were all a little through at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I went to sleep, but I could read.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I made it very much.
Mm-hmm. But you came back in 42. The question I was
to a mad physicist for my journey in 42.
Mm-hmm.
Very able man, what was his name? Committed suicide in Switzerland later. He looked very dotty. Came from Prague. Was a very eminent nuclear physicist who was flying from somewhere, I don't know, America, back to Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
and looked very eccentric with straws through his hair, and he said to me, you'll see what will happen. When you arrive in England, everyone will be passed, I should be held up for half an hour. And it was also, what was his name? Yes.
Anyway, you came back, and what was your impression?
Patrick.
Right. What was your impression?
I had a very good time with him. He told me all about his new progress of physics and everything else.
Right.
What is?
What was your impression of Britain in 42 in the war? It must have been very grim.
Yes, well, grim. I expected it.
Mm-hmm.
I went, where did I stay? I must have stayed in London a bit. I went to Oxford. I found my parents there.
Mm-hmm.
Who had evacuated to Oxford, in part from London. I saw old friends. I went to London. I went around various ministries. Because I was supposed to be an informant. That's what went on in America. I talked to people in the Foreign Office. Eden was on the least interesting in the I'd seen.
Mm.
The most bored of all the officials I saw.
Right.
Could hardly listen.
Why?
Can't tell you. Just was bored, wasn't in what to do.
Yeah.
Just terribly bored. I didn't see Churchill. I saw everybody in the Ministry of Information
mm-hmm.
to which I was attached, man by man. I saw Dick Law. Was number two, who was fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
With the way I contracted lifelong friendship.
Mm-hmm.
I
number two in the MOI?
No, in the Foreign Office.
In the Foreign Office, sorry.
Mother-in-law's son.
Oh, right.
He was called Richard Law.
Right.
And he was supposed to be a rather liberal-minded minister who later became violently Tory. And from Eden was Nearly drove us from me, practically drove out of politics. Mm. I met an MP, became a lord. Mm. I don't know what he's called. Practically knows me.
How long were you there in England?
Then I went to stay the night with, was in 42? No, it was later. I went to London, dinner with Beaverbrook mm-hmm. in 42.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
I can tell you. My master was Brendan Bracken, who was Minister of Information. Mm. He worked for two masters.
Yeah.
One was Churchill, the other was Beaverbrook. Mm. Two quite separate masters. For some reason, he told Beaverbrook that he ought to see me. I was asked to dinner at some hotel in London for Mr. Adolf Burley, who was number three in the State Department, mm. who'd come to discuss something like airspace after the war. Something, I don't know, some kind of negotiation. Mm. I can't believe that it was done in airspace during the war, but it may have been. And not something I knew anything about. The dinner of the day was for him, attended by five or six members of parliament, mm-hmm. people were the host, Burley was guest of honor, and one of the officials, 14 people, you know. I'd never met Beaverbrook before. I sat next to him. He asked me the usual questions. Who is your father? Who is your mother? Where are you educated? What do you do? So, close that, tell you about that. He then turned his attention.
Very rough, very aggressive, abrasive.
Yes, not rough, yes. Staccato questions. And then he said, turn to Burley. And he said, now, Dr. Burley. To me, took it obviously instant. Like, Burley was madly Anglophobe.
Phobe.
From way beyond. Yeah. His father was a German missionary in Persia. Yeah. He was of German extraction. Yeah. Father was my grandfather before he came to America. His father was an American missionary, was very German.
Yeah.
Lutheran missionary in yeah. Persia. And he was a New Dealer, and he loathed British Empire, the English. And he was an awfully nasty little man. And that's just by the way. Very cultivated, and interested in the Ramon La Rose, married a Cabot. Mm-hmm. And they were taught on Freud. They used to pursue each other through the house. They called each other lover. And this was apparently according to prescription for behaving like young lovers. It was all very odd. But anyway, a crooked smile of peculiarly repellent nature. But anyway, he said, now, Dr. Burley, waiter, take some more wine for Dr. Burley. Dr. Burley is a very well-known gourmet. He's known over the world as a gourmet. He likes good food and wine. He wouldn't have come here if he didn't think we have marvelous food and wine. Oh, good Burley began to shiver, as he was meant to.
Mm-hmm.
The waiter there appeared and served him, and Burley said, I bought him. Drink very little wine. Oh, come, Dr. Burley. You're just being shy. You're just trying to deceive us, Dr. Burley. We all know your great reputation as a trenchman. Dr. Burley, you're famous worldwide. Don't try and conceal yourself. You're a great friend to this country. You can't behave. The persecution was absolutely continuous. Continuous. I've never seen anything of the politically rather odd. At this point, Burley got up and then he had two Labour members saying, ah, Burley, how do you spell your name? B, he said, B-E-R-L-E. Should be B-U-R-L-E-Y. No, if you did that, you'd be one of us. Ridiculous, but his awful German way. I know. You change your name. We do this ribbing, chuffing.
Burley it's a wonder this alliance himself, survived.
He contracted himself to frog-like. I can't tell you. He shivered.
Yeah.
It was a very sort of thin, pale, rather mean-looking little man.
Yeah.
Anyway, he then got up to make his speech and said, my father was a missionary in Persia, and his task was to try and give spiritual and, if possible, some degree of material comfort to the victims of imperialism, more particularly British imperialism, the misdeeds of which in Persia hit into my father's soul. We all know the dreadful conduct of the oppressive British boot, crushing totally unarmed and obedient natives. It went on like this.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes. Then it
didn't last. This is a revenge, or?
Yes. Then we all dispersed after that. I rather enjoyed it. It's an unusual scene. His Anglophobia was not improved by this. But I enjoyed it all. Because it's odd. It's out of this world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, people didn't mind that in the least. Thrah! Thank you, Dr. Burley. Cracking jokes at our expense. He's just being funny, you know. He really loves us. Come on, come on. Come on, waiter. Serve Dr. Burley. Never mind about the rest of us. He then asked me about my family, what I was doing, and that was that. He didn't.
Yeah.
But later when I met him, of course, I was off the job by him.
When was this?
45.
Yes.
When I came back and was waiting at Moscow, I was summoned by him at the top of Arlington House, Arlington Street where he lived, penthouse. And this was after I'd done all these, my dispatch was required, what's called a certain measure of fame, and he offered me a job. He'd been recommended by his journalists, Daily Express journalists. He offered me a job on the Evening Standard, to write a weekly political article on the English character. Of course, I should have said this very great compliment, Lord Newbrook. I really must think it over. Instead of which, I behaved very badly. I behaved like a Swiss governess whose virtue was being attempted. I said, no. It's not at all something I can do. He looked frightfully cross, obviously, and said, why not? I said, well, you know, I've got no facilities, this kind of thing. I'm not really a very good journalist, and I find it a very difficult thing to do. I don't think my sort of thing at all. I really wouldn't be any good to you. At this point, he said, where are you going? He said, going to Moscow. There you'll sit in some back room. You'll be doing nothing. You'll get no job. You're in Washington. You did this and all that stuff. My goodness me. You had this awful man over you, Lord Halifax. I expect you liked him. Let me tell you about him. He then told me the story which Churchill tells in his book about how Churchill became Prime Minister. Remember the famous scene in Downing Street.
No, I
can't. Oh, well, it's the memoirs. When Chamberlain realized he had to go, he and Halifax and Churchill were summoned by Chamberlain to attend Downing Street. Chamberlain said, I'm afraid my contract, no good, I can't continue. President, and one of you will have to replace him. I think Edward will do it very well, and so on. Edward said, no, Winston will do it far better, politely. Winston didn't say anything. He said, silence is golden. Didn't say, well, I don't know, to Edward. Not at all. It was silent. At this point, Chamberlain went back to Edward Halifax. Halifax, again, I think quite sincerely, said he thought Winston would be rather more suitable in the circumstances. And Winston said, yes, I agree. That was the end of that.
Yes.
Well, Beaverbrook said, when I discovered that, I asked Churchill whether he would mind my telling Halifax. No, I'm sorry, no. Wasn't that, I said. I'm very pleased. Country was saved. He said, country was saved. I admitted something. He said, then, when Winston decided to send Halifax to America, it wasn't long after, it wasn't very long, 6 months or so, I just asked for the privilege of being able to tell him myself. I went to the Foreign Office. He was out. I waited for 3 hours, and I was able to tell Halifax that he'd been sacked. I enjoyed that moment. You know, he behaved quite well. Didn't bat an eyelid. Accepted it. I told him, Prime Minister Bush was in Italy. You've been appointed ambassador to Washington. His wife went round, saw Winston that night, and said, why are you exiling Lord Edward? He didn't say anything to me. What I forgot to tell you is in 1944, whereas this is 45
years. The story's being told.
In 1944, I was asked for a weekend by Beaverbrook.
Mm-hmm.
And no doubt, again, I did go because I had no 1950s, but in bracket ordered them to go. Mm-hmm. So I went. I think it's 44. I can get it right. Well, I went to Turkey. There were the Dr. Dalton, who was president of the Board of Trade. Fulbright was in London.
JW.
Yes. A man called, somebody who was head of Hayes, who was the owner of Hayes Wharf, who was the minister in Dalton Ministry, some kind of high up official. At that time, it's a wartime. It's called something, it was one of Beaverbrook's friends. And his secretary, who was a poor thing, who was sort of his intellectual. We hired a secretary. I arrived at about 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, we all went to film in Beaverbrook's house and lasted about 2.5 hours. He fell asleep, snored. We were offered drinks, and then went to dinner. I tried to be charmed by him. Everybody else was there, but failed. Mm. No good.
Mm. What was it that repelled you?
Extreme coarseness. Sort of coarse jokes. Nastiness. Sheer nastiness of character. I couldn't help it. I thought he was one of the nastiest men. Bad man. Nastiest men I'd ever met. And the jokes which I just didn't think funny. Couldn't laugh at them. Either one does, one doesn't.
Yes.
And the conversation took the following one. I stayed 2 nights. That night we disbanded afterwards, because for now, because it's quite late. Nothing happened, I don't know what to talk about. Next day, I had a hard day for him. And then at dinner, he was out for lunch, or had it by himself. I wandered around the house in a gloomy way, talked to Fulbright, talked to Dalton a bit, who's equally awful man to talk to. Loud voiced, coarse, noisy.
Yeah.
The patron of all these Crosslands and Crossbones, nobody else.
No, and Ben Pinlot.
Everybody is. I didn't even know Pinlot.
No, but in Pinlot then when I wrote his biography.
Yes. I know, but he was homosexual, you see,
yeah.
Dalton fundamentally.
Yeah.
But he was a great patron of Labour intellectuals. Mm-hmm. Gateskill and Crossland.
Yes.
And I think Jenkins.
Yes.
His boys.
Yes.